Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Way of the Dreamer. This is the radio show where we affirm the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination. We have a wonderful guest today, Jean Van Bronckhorst. She's devoted many years of her life to helping those approaching death and those entering the afterlife, actually, and their families, as a grief counselor, as a hospice social worker, and she's written the most beautiful book. It's called Dreams at the Threshold, Dreams at the Threshold. It is deeply simple and simply deep, and it makes us aware, which is true of any context where dreams might be shared. You don't have to be an expert, you don't have to be an analyst, you don't need to have diplomas on the wall in order to make a useful contribution in creating a safe space to share dreams and help someone to find the story value and perhaps the navigational guidance that is waiting for them in their dreams. Welcome, Jean.
Welcome. Thank you very much. I'm very, very glad to be here.
Well, I am delighted to have read your book twice. I read it when it first came out, and there's a quote from me on the back cover, which is only part of what I feel about it. So I feel so much more. I mean, the great distinction of your approach is how perfectly, limpidly simple it is. I mean, basically, if I'm quoting you correctly, doing this without looking at my notes or looking at the book, you tell us, you know, for family, for friends, assisting someone who might be nearing death, basically three things to keep in mind. The first is, well, having understood that dreams might be important, dreams might be very helpful, dreams might actually open a path to the next world and provide, of course, stories and entertainment that people can share. A new story for someone who is dead, written, is a great thing to have. You tell us basically three very simple things that you need to keep in mind if you are going to assist someone in the last stage of life with their dreams. First of all, you help to create a safe space where they feel it's okay to tell their dream story. Secondly, you listen up, you let them tell the story, and you welcome it, and perhaps you invite it in. Perhaps you invite it in by saying to them, as you like to do, how are your dreams lately? What are you dreaming, or are you dreaming? You invite the dreams in, you welcome them. And then part of the welcome, the third thing is you don't interpret, you don't analyze, you let the dream create its own space and its own flow. Is that more or less a summary of your approach?
That's wonderful. Yes, actually it is. I think I was looking for a way to help people talk about dreams even if they didn't feel like they were dream experts. And I think one of the things that kind of got off track at the beginning was Freud and Jung were so educated, and they were using the language of the Greek and Roman myths, and they were kind of talking to each other and to other educated people, and then they put it in psychoanalysis, and you got this idea that somehow dreams were either too precious or too frightening for us to handle on our own. And what we're finding, what research is finding, is that when people talk about dreams outside of a dream work frame, they're really using the dreams to talk about something else. So people might tell a dream in one sentence in order to say the next thing that they want to say. So that dreams become a form of communication, of kind of opening a conversation. And I think that's really important to hold on to. I like dream work, and I am in a couple of different dream work groups. But for people who are not in dream work groups and you're just living your life, dreams themselves can be such a source of comfort if we allow them room into the conversation and then let the conversation go where it's going to go.
Yes, as I say, it's so simple, it's so colloquial, it's so everyday. Of course, as you say, Freud and Jung were both very educated gentlemen. Freud also, although he said he was a secular Jew, had the rabbinical attitude that authority was all important. I remember him saying to Jung when they were traveling to the United States together on a boat, Freud was about to share one of his own dreams, and he pulled himself back and he said nervously to Jung, "I can't tell that to you, it might challenge my authority. I can't tell you my dream for fear that my authority will be at risk." Jung was much better. I mean, Jung says in one of his essays on dream analysis that it's far less important that the analyst should understand the dream than the patient would understand the dream. But nonetheless, Jung, with his immense education, his mastery of languages, the classics, and all the rest of it, as you say, and his science, was a daunting figure for all but a few elite members of the group that consulted him. So it was very difficult for Jung, given his presence and his authority, to pull it back and let people do their own thing. Anyway,
yes,
what you affirm so beautifully, so simply, is we can all do something, and you tell us that we want to do something in relation to dreams, like create a space where someone approaching death can tell a dream. Because one thing, they now have a story. I mean, this is just so obvious when we read it from you and from the experiences that you quote. And so important in any context, not just approaching death. I mean, if people pay attention to their dreams and recover a few, they have something new to say, don't they? I mean, they have a story, even if it's only one line. And if someone is bedridden and really feels out of everything they used to be part of, what a gift to just know you have a fresh story. And to be assured by someone close to you that they're willing to hear it, that is creating a safe space in a very important way.
That is. I think you're right. I think it just gives people the chance to still contribute to their family. You know, there's a researcher named Harvey Chochenoff in Winnipeg, who talks about at the end of life, if people have a project, if they have something they can do with their families to talk about their lives, it gives them meaning and purpose, and it helps them have an easier dying. And I think dreams can work the same way. That I talked to one woman who said that when her mother was sick, she and her mother decided they would just talk about dreams. And the dreams came, and as she got closer to dying, the dreams changed, and she wrote them down, and she passed them on to her siblings, and it became this great gift that her mother gave the family. And an important piece for her mother to do.
Turn it to you for a moment. When you think back over your life, is there a moment you remember, a dream you remember, which was a real turning point for you? Maybe there were a series, but when you think about a dream that might have shaped and oriented your approach to everything, to life itself, to the work that you undertook, is there a dream that was that kind of turning point dream?
I had a lot of dreams. I'm kind of laughing.
Yes, of course you've had a lot of dreams.
I don't know which one to pick. I think for me the dreams that I've held on to, especially early on, were the more extraordinary dreams that kind of pushed me to think about what is time and how do we navigate this. And I was having dreams that my parents thought were bad, and so it really forced me again into a question of kind of who has authority and what do I do when the people who I have always trusted to tell me how the world works are clearly not seeing what I'm seeing, and when do I step back and fight against myself, and when do I embrace kind of what my own experience is. So a lot of my dreams were about kind of trusting myself and sorting through on my own kind of what I thought all this meant. And I was at one point at 13, I was like, okay, what I'm going to do three steps. I'm going to figure out how time works. And then the second step is I'll figure out how to have a precognitive dream on demand. And then the third step is I'm going to point it towards something in the future and show my parents, and then they'll believe me. It was a great list. But really, wow, I got stuck on that first thing of what is time. as I think everybody has.
Well, here we go again, because I have not yet, I'm absolutely certain I have not yet read your previous book on premonitions. I'll have to get to that now, because it's one of my own main interests, as you probably know. I wrote a whole book called Dreaming the Future about our relationships with time in dreams, and it's become a major preoccupation of mine. Again, I wouldn't say it's a ruling preoccupation, but I'm extremely interested in this question of time and dreaming and how we learn about it. So talk to us a little bit about that. Talk to us about your interest in premonitions. Talk to us about how your own experience of precognitive and other premonitory dreams, the teenager it seems, might have liberated you and helped you to establish an independent position in relation to what's going on in dreaming.
It really did, because there really weren't that many rules out there when I was a child growing up. It felt like I was learning most of my rules from Star Trek, which probably was not the best
Why
way
not?
To go.
That's contemporary mythology. We might have forgotten Ovid and Apollonius and the other sources on Greek or Roman mythology, but we have Star Trek. Yeah, go on.
We have Star Trek. When you're 10, 12, you have Star Trek. That's what I started with. Who, you know, and their prime directive was you don't go back into the past and you don't change it, because then the future will be destroyed. And so if I had a premonition about something that was coming up, could I in fact change it, or did I need to live through it the same way? And would the world be destroyed if I changed what I did? And it was a real question for me.
And based on your experience, what conclusions did you reach? Could you change the future?
I reached the point where I realized that I could make any changes that I wanted, and that whatever I was destroying was no longer something I was going to live through. So I had a moment where, with a friend of mine, a childhood friend, we were walking home, and she asked me what my favorite color was, and I saw a puddle, and I had a flash, like a deja vu, but I knew the next, like, 30 seconds that we would end up in a big fight, and so I said something different than the last time, and I showed her the puddle that was there, and then she didn't step in it, and she didn't get dirty, and we didn't laugh about that, and she didn't get mad because I was laughing at her, and, you know, it was like this whole thing that I could see, I just navigated around.
But in the dream, you or she were in the puddle, but in waking life, when that caught up with the dream, you're able to avoid the puddle because you remembered the dream. Is that more or less it?
Exactly.
Right.
And so,
you know, we're talking about, what is that you start the conversation? That's great. It's always best when we enter the realm of the unexpected. But I've been engaged in really quite significant debate, really. I mean, it's going to be a debate which you'll be able to read about because there are articles and so on. With the people who are now adopting the determinist position that we are four-dimensional beings and it's all set. We can see the future and the past, but it's all set. Inside the so-called block universe, where we actually can't change anything, we can see it but can't change anything. I detest this idea. I mean, the idea that we can see across time but not change it. I mean, what's the point in doing it, Ben? And I'm going to share a story of my own, Jean. I don't think you've read this one. I don't know how much of my work you've read, but I don't think you've read this one. It's a little bit, it's on the order of avoiding the puddle, but actually it's avoiding death on the road. So if I may tell it to you, this is one of the things that has shaped permanently my attitude. And it also involves recognizing that there might be markers in dreams as to what is going on. You develop a sense of your personal marker, your personal symbol. So I'm dreaming, I'm driving on a road I know well. It's a road called Route 2 in upstate New York. It runs past the house where I was living at the time. And in the dream, I'm driving, it's perfectly normal, driving up the hill. And then everything comes to the stop, to a stop at a fork in the road. And there's a gas station, convenience store across the fork, beyond the fork. And the sky turns strange. It's a sort of, the clouds are like purple bruises in a yellow sky. And suddenly I'm vaulted into a series of surreal situations. It switches quickly from black and white to color and back again. And in the dream, now lucid, I realize I'm in the afterlife, but I'm in a very confused bardo that I don't wish to be in, and I don't know how to navigate. And at this point, I realize I better come back from the dream and pay very careful attention to where the action stopped, this fork in the road. So I come back from the dream. I can identify exactly where the action stopped. And I know, because this is my marker, that if I'm not very careful at that point in the road, physical death might be awaiting me. I know that because I was thrown into a confused bardo state that I didn't want. 3 weeks later, I'm on the road, heading east on Route 2. I come to the fork in the road, and there's a big brown UPS truck blocking my view, parked on a double yellow. Normally, I just pull out round it. Because I recognize the dream spot, I slow to a halt. I avoid a head-on collision with the 18-wheeler coming down the hill at 60 miles an hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. Now, you know, some people might say it's anecdotal. Well, Gene, you and I know that what is anecdotal can save you from the puddle or save you from the head-on collision with the 18-wheeler. So that, to me, is permanent evidence seared into my memory of the fact that, you know, if we can see the future, we might change it for the better to the extent of avoiding a premature and unwanted physical death. So I've operated in that spirit in relation to premonitions and precognition probably all my life. I've always thought it is our duty and our choice, hopefully, to practice free will and exercise as much choice as we possibly can and not be bound to some, you know, version of determinism. It seems as if we're on the same page when it comes to that.
I agree. You know, I agree completely. And I used the practice of the puddle to change other times in my life to avoid terrible things or to get good things. But
that's a wonderful phrase, practice of the puddles. That could be a very good chapter title if you haven't used it already.
The practice of the puddle. That's good. That's good writing.
Very good writing. It's alliterative without being, you know, tedious, Lisa. The practice of puddles. The practice of the puddle. I mean, it's really good. We're going to have to talk again about premonitions and precognition, Gene. You know, we really are. Because, as I say, it's come back into my ken. And I'm actually in the process of writing more about it, though actually what I write this time might take the form of fiction rather than nonfiction.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so this also sort of widens the discussion because, as you and I know, I mean, the time to think about dreaming and the time to think about death is any day, any time. When I've led my death workshops, I've led a very popular workshop called Making Death Your Ally over the years, more advanced psychopomp trainings and so on. Whenever I start those things, I will ask the group, who knows someone who is dying? And you can probably picture the scene. Some hands go up and some do not. And then I'll say, okay, put up your hand if you do not put up your hand. People put up their hands and I say, think again. Do you know someone who is dying? And eventually they get it. We're all dying all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, your focus in this beautiful book, Dreams of the Threshold, is very specifically on those who are physically dying, who have a limited amount of their physical life term remaining. But you and I also know that the time to think about death, how to approach death, what might happen after death is any day. Because, as a French essayist said, we do not know where death is waiting for us, so we must be ready to meet death anywhere.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's difficult. It's difficult for people to think about. But I think that was one of the gifts I got from working in hospice, is how much it helped me personally kind of come to terms with my own living and dying and what I wanted for my life and really kind of how I wanted to live my life, because it was easy to see every day how precious the time is. And even if you believe, as I do, that there's an afterlife and there's more coming, that to me just, again, makes this life precious.
Yes.
Because it's limited, because there's only so much time. How am I gonna live? How am I gonna spend this? Become real questions.
You have these beautiful stories. There are many of them of someone in hospice care, someone who might have been really almost catatonic in the sense of not talking to people, not feeling they had anything to say, never smiling, not being happy, who suddenly perks up when you ask a question, or one of the people you quote asks a question like, you know, how's your dream life? You had any dreams? Perks up and then actually begins to tell something. And then realizes that they have the power to command an audience now because they've got some kind of a story, even if they've been bedridden for a long time and never been out and about. I mean, these are beautiful moments. And sometimes the moments seem to allow someone to approach what lies ahead with courage and grace. Certainly on the way to that, they seem to expand the depth and the intimacy of the family circle so people are actually communing and bonding and coming together again.
Yes. And I think some of those dreams, some of the most powerful dreams at the end of life are those visitation dreams where they are either dreaming or having a vision of someone they love who has returned and is looking healthy and well and whole and exuding a kind of love that they may or may not have exuded in life. They come back as their best selves, really, with none of the emotional troubles that they might have had. And they come back with the idea that they're there to help them and guide them on to the next life. And they have done remarkable research where they've been able to show that people who have these experiences and at least talk about it, or at least that they were witnessed by nurses, the nurses have shown that that what that did for them in their own dying, it raised the possibility of them having a calm and peaceful death. Without that experience, about 40% of people have a calm and peaceful death. But with that experience, about 89% of people have a calm and peaceful death. And that's
These are very useful statistics to give to people. And I'm with you on the importance and the caring of the nurses in this scene. Back in 1990, I taught a short introduction to philosophy course for nurses at a teaching hospital in upstate New York. And what happened in that course was profoundly instructive. We're talking with Jean Van Bronckhorst, again, the author of Dreams at the Threshold. She's done really important and wonderful work assisting people, both the patient or the hospice resident and their families, to approach death with courage and grace. We're talking about dreams in an even broader sense. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Mast. We'll be back after the break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Please go over to my website, mossdreams.com. You'll find I'm launching a new online course today at Invention Shamanic Lucid Dreaming for the Shift Network. We're going to do all sorts of things. We're going to find places of sanctuary and healing in non-ordinary reality. We're going to link up with spiritual allies and guides. We're going to reach to a higher self. We'll learn more of our multidimensional family, all sorts of adventures. But we're talking about the profound life adventure of Jean Van Bronckhorst right now. She is the author of Dreams at the Threshold. I strongly recommend this book. It's one of my absolute favorite books on how to approach death and dying with care and concern and compassion for the person approaching death and the family, and how to use dreams to bring them together. Jean, like many of us who are, let us say, in the dream work movement in the modern sense, is a legatee of the great Montague Ullman, who I knew briefly who, clinical psychiatrist, who hung up his diplomas and his authority and said, let's learn to say in the presence of a dream, if it were my dream, and not pretend we need an expert for authority, because at the end of the day, the dream is the expert on their own dream. But Jean, in terms of helping ordinary people to do extraordinary things, takes it even further. She insists we don't actually need to offer any understanding, let alone interpretation or analysis of a dream. If we simply create a space where it's safe to tell a dream, listen to it deeply, welcome it, and see where it goes, we're doing a world of good. I agree with it.
Yeah.
It's very important practice.
It does go in different places. I've got an example for you. This is hypothetical, so there wasn't anyone who actually said this, but I've got a dream that could be told in three different ways. So the first one was I was out running like I used to. I dreamed I was out running like I used to. I was very relaxed. I woke up feeling energy from that. I remember who I was, who I am. I'm an athlete. I'm a competitor, and I'm going to keep running. I'm going to keep fighting. Someone else says, I was out running like I used to. I was very relaxed, and I woke up thinking, that's all gone now. I don't have that anymore. And he moves into a story about grief, and we talk about the grief of what's been lost. Somebody else says, I was out running like I used to, very relaxed. And I woke up, though, I was thinking about how I always ran to get away from things. Maybe it's time to stop running and face this. And that's someone who's kind of examining the dream for insight. So each one of those, that person is saying a little bit of their dream in order to move to saying something about themselves and something about their lives. And that's what I've found. By just giving them room, the dream itself is maybe a sentence. I dreamed the other day that I was painting again. Did I ever tell you I was a painter? Oh, I was a good painter. I could have been good, but I got married and I had kids and put it away, and I would not trade those kids for anything. They are so wonderful. Have you seen pictures of my grandchildren? And you can feel this person doing this sense of a life review, a sense of looking back over those pivotal moments in her life when she had to make that decision between being an artist and being a mother and which way she wanted to go. And so the dream becomes like a diving board. Instead of diving into the dream, you're using it to dive into a person's life. And it's just really, it's been really beautiful. I read an account by, we were talking about Freud earlier, a Freudian psychoanalyst in the 70s who was working with people who were dying, and he said something very similar, that he was working with a woman who was terrified of dying, and there was no escape for her. There was no escape from the terror until one day she came in, or he came to her, and she said, I dreamed about my brother and my mother last night. And they had both died earlier, and he knew that. And he said, well, tell me what they were like. And so she just talked about what her mother was like and what her brother was like and who they were and how they felt about her and how she felt about them. And there was something in that telling that helped her relax and helped her get ready to move towards seeing them. And she had a more peaceful dying than she would have had.
Mm.
So
you talked very eloquently about the visitation dreams. To what extent, how often did you notice that people dreaming in this stage of life were being given glimpses of what's waiting for them on the other side? Besides the fact that their departed loved ones are clearly alive in the sense that they're turning up somewhere near them in the space, were some of them reporting experiences which seemed like tours, guided tours or advanced tours of what prospects lie ahead after death? Was that a feature from these
dreams? I've heard of that, but I haven't seen that myself. So I don't have any anecdotes for you. I certainly had people talk about being on ships or on cruises or on planes and being in that travel mode. And most visitation dreams, it seems like they don't talk so much about where they are or give a glimpse of the afterworld as much as the fact that they're there and safe implies a safe place from which they are visiting
Right, so the predominant experience for the visitation dreams and the sense of what waits on the big journey beyond this life is not of set locales or welcome centers or places of life review beyond death, but it is the sense of safety and assurance in facing what might still be largely unknown, because you know you're in the presence of familiar faces who care for
exactly.
you and can help see
and,
you through.
And I have found, even with people who don't have visitation dreams, but the people I've worked with who are dying, when they think of heaven or when they think of the afterlife, the thing that comes up most often, almost always, is just, I will see people that I love again. That connection, that feeling of reunion, that wanting to see people that we love who we've lost already, that's primary. I can't even remember a time when someone has tried to imagine what heaven was like, other than heaven is being able to see my loved one again.
You're talking about visitations by humans who've passed over. Did people in these situations also talk about contact with beloved animals, with pets that had shared their lives?
I've heard of that, and I think that can happen. I haven't seen it myself, but I know that people have reported that. Sometimes people have talked about seeing angels or Jesus or religious figures. And again, the research is showing that when we do see religious figures, we tend to see religious figures from the religion that we know. When there was a big study done looking at the difference between Christians in the United States and Hindus in India, and again, across the board, they mostly saw people that they knew and loved, that they wanted to connect to, but when they saw religious figures, of course the Hindus were seeing the religious figures that fit their religion, figures that fit their own religion.
Right. That makes sense, particularly in the context you're talking about. I've also noticed with dreamers in general, not just in this situation, that sometimes they're shocked by the form that the spiritual guide or teacher takes. Sometimes it's because the figure comes from outside the traditions they know. Sometimes because it's they think, for example, they're a recovering Catholic. Mary turns up. Or Jesus turns up. Or an angel turns up, and they realize that there's something still in the old-time religion in which they're raised. Even if they think they left it behind, the guide is still going to appear that way. I'm talking to Jean Van Bronckhorst. She's the author of Dreams at the Threshold, a very simple and powerful way of learning how to celebrate dreams and the gift they give for life review and for getting ready to pass into the next world. We'll be back after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Knopf.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
To Way of the Dream with Robert Moss, do pop over to mossdreams.com, my website. You'll find access to articles from my blog, my new books, my new online courses, the next online training that teaches active dreaming, which we're actually starting in February. Our wonderful guest today is Jean Van Bronckhorst, author of Dreams at the Threshold, and I've warned Jean I need to commit one of my stories. I need to tell her one of my stories, which I think starts out by illustrating rather splendidly her central thesis, which is it's enough for us to make a space for dreams and listen to them. This story is in one of my books. I think it's in Dreamways of the Iroquois, since I'm talking to someone in Canada. I'm allowed to say Iroquois rather than Iroquois, Dreamways of the Iroquois, in a chapter on helping the dying. And so Katie, who was one of my students, was the daughter of a man who led a decent life, but he made no room for inner experience, never shared a dream in his life, no meditation, nothing like that. So now he's in a nursing home, and his body's not working very well. And Katie goes to see him almost every day, and she says, simply, as Jean would recommend, have any dreams? You have any dreams? Tell me, oh, you and your dreams, you and your new age friends, you know, I don't dream. Right. Well, one day he does dream, and it's a rather embarrassing dream. It reflects the state of his plumbing, which isn't working very well. It's about a garden hose that's squirting all over the place and won't behave. And he tells the dream with some embarrassment. Then they both start laughing because it's just brought his medical situation to a sort of humorous, cartoonish state. Then he starts dreaming regularly and telling his dreams. He's got a series of new jobs. This is unlike in ordinary reality. He's had strokes. He's in his 80s. And one of his jobs involves carpentry, which he loved but never made time for. Another of his dreams, he's got a new job ironing out angel's wings. You see, he explains to his daughter, angels get very rumpled and disheveled when they fly around. So he's got a job smoothing out angel's wings. That's very cute. And this goes on for 6 months. And then at the high point of the sharing, Dad says, oh, listen, I went to the most wonderful dinner. Yes, Dad? Where? Ah, it was this mansion, this white mansion on top of a hill. And this man in a black tie wearing a sash like an ambassador over his starched shirt, he welcomes me, and I'm embarrassed because I'm wearing a hospital gown which is flapping open at the back, and he doesn't seem to notice that you're most welcome. They dine and wine me with the best champagne, the best filet mignon, except it's better than any of that stuff. And at the end of the evening, says Dad, they say to me, the ambassador says to me, you have our address. We'll be waiting for you when the time comes. So Dad comes back and from the dream. And he knows the man who always wanted the right address. He's quite well-connected, quite successful businessman. He's got the right address. He has this absolute confidence. So now he proceeds to go through death, to go into death with absolute confidence. And after his death, Jean, he appears to Katie, the daughter, in a dream and says, I want to take you to that white mansion on the hill and introduce my new friends. Well, if we need to be agnostics about the content of that, we can be agnostics, but I think we can all agree being merely psychological or therapeutic or, you know, caregiving about it, that these dreams gave fantastic life and zest to the last months of the fellow's life in the nursing home and enabled him to go forward into what might otherwise have been the great unknown with absolute confidence and grace.
Yes.
And that all started not with any dream work, but with simply saying, Dad, if you have a dream, I'd love you to share it.
Yeah, just sharing the dream. I love that. That's a great story. I had one. I was working with a friend of mine who died, and she was an atheist. And as she got sicker and sicker, she got more confused. And then she was talking about, was I packing? I think I'm going somewhere. And she wasn't really sure. And then one day I came in and she said, I was on a cruise last night and it was great. And we just spent time. I just sat down to tell me about it. So for 15 or 20 minutes, we went through what this cruise was like. And she also mentioned the decent champagne. She had a little bit of a snobbishness to her. So it wasn't great, but it was decent champagne. And she liked the band and she liked the dancing. And she, you know, this woman who's been in a wheelchair for years is talking about dancing and that everybody had their own cruise director. And she really liked that. There were a lot of people there. And I said, well, where did it go? She goes, well, it went over somewhere. It went to the other side. And I said, and what happened there? She goes, well, everybody else got off, but I decided to come back because my cruise director was brand new to the job and she wasn't really that well trained. And I thought maybe I could give her some pointers on the way back. I just thought that was hysterical. I said, well, that sounds good. I said, well, maybe I hope next time you go that she'll be better trained and she'll be all ready. And she kind of looked at me and said, oh, do I get to go again? And I shrugged my shoulders. I said, I hope so. And that was as close as we got.
I love that story. I remember that. I particularly liked it. And it has a sort of tag of authenticity. The feel of authenticity in the phrase. It was a decent champagne. Not it was great champagne, but merely decent. I mean, that's the sort of tag that tells you this is absolutely for real. And the business that a tour director wasn't yet sufficiently trained. I mean, you've got a novice, you've got a newbie. Yeah. That's a charming detail too. I mean, we grow our guides, perhaps, you know, in life and then beyond life. And grow our guides.
She was that kind of person that would definitely need to have a personally trained guide.
Of course. She has certain standards, and she's not going to let them slip despite her situation. Now, that is one of my favorite stories in your book. It's full of good stories like this, actually. And there's such a good-heartedness about it. There's such a basic common decency. My goodness, that's a quality we'd like to see everywhere in life these days, isn't it? Just some basic good human decency and kindness. I mean, you're a very kind person, Jean. You quote very kind people in the hospice and nursing communities. I must tell you, I mean, over the 30-plus years of my teaching public workshops in dreaming and shamanism, creative imagination, the number one occupational group in my programs has been nurses, equal with visual artists. These are sort of neck and neck. And it probably started when I teach a little philosophy course at a teaching hospital back in 1990. And I said to the nurses, okay, I want you to write down on these scraps of paper, you know, what question you would ask if the person in front of you was the guide who could not fight you, whether you see that as Jesus or Buddha or Moses or whoever you imagine. I want you to write down the thing you would most ask to learn about in the presence of that guide who you know cannot lie. And I go home with the bits of paper, and more than half the nurses had written down what happens after death, and some had added, how do I know for sure? So we turned the whole course, I threw over the curriculum completely. We turned the whole course into a course in dreams and visions and other ways of gaining first-hand knowledge of what lies beyond death. And it was incredibly rich. The experiences of these nurses, who are often the last people, as you know, to turn off the respirator or see someone alive, the experiences these people brought from their role in caring for patients, and the experiences they were then able to harvest as they learned to dream lucidly and learned to make shamanic journeys and so on, and learned to go beyond, you know, were quite extraordinary. And I, you know, I really felt myself sitting at their feet, feeling such great respect for all they have to put up with and for the courage that they have to evince in the presence of MDs who think that MD stands a minor deity.
Some
of their friends are doctors, but I have to say that in the presence of nurses. So I very much appreciate the use you made in your book of the testimony of nurses and other people like that. All right, we're talking to Jean Van Bronckhorst, and the time is flying, as it does when you're doing well. We'll be back for one more 8-minute segment after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss.
All your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcasting coders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com. Is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Sway of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our guest is Jean Van Bronckhorst. Her excellent book is Dreams at the Threshold. It's about helping patients and families, the elderly, approach death with courage and grace. Jean, I've noticed, perhaps you have too, that there is a difference between those of us who know that there's life beyond death through personal experience and those who do not. Yes, there are people who believe in it. Yes, there are people who don't believe in it. Have different opinions, but there's a difference between belief and experience. And those of us who had some kind of experience, whether it's been a visitation by the departed or a big dream, maybe a big shamanic journey beyond death, or been through what is now called the ND, the near-death experience, have a different opinion. I was pronounced clinically dead when I was 3 years old, as you possibly know, and so I've had a long engagement with this area, and I've known to my certain satisfaction since then that there's life beyond death, because I've been there. I didn't think of it as a near-death experience. I thought of it as dying and coming back, which is what the doctor said when I was 3 years old. Oh, yeah, your boy, he died and he came back, didn't he?
Yeah.
What are your own impressions of what happens after death? Do you have a landscape in mind? Do you have a range of options in mind? Do you have personal experience that makes you confident that the soul or consciousness survives death?
It's a good question. I think that after death is non-physical, and that's something that I can't quite imagine. And I don't know that anyone else physically, I don't know. For myself, I can't imagine it. So what I assume happens after death is that I, being out of my body, I go back to my dreaming muscles, and I will dream a place where I can be and people that I can see, and I will have a three-dimensional reality in that Bardo state where I kind of sort out my bearings and figure out what happens next. But beyond that, I haven't seen. I've certainly seen that near-death experience dream state and felt the power of that. But I'm not sure what happens after that.
But that's a very commonsensical and very wise and practical approach. So it's absolutely great. I'm a little bit skeptical in the sense, Jean. I mean, I think that in dreams, whether or not we realize it, we're often traveling in realms where people are alive after death. Whether or not we recognize that the people we are with are deceased, whether or not they are deceased, I think that much of the territory that we travel, because dreaming can be traveling, actually might resemble or actually be tantamount to the landscapes that we'll find after physical death in certain stages of the transition. Jane Roberts' entity, Seth, who's good value, I'm not a fan of channeled material in general, but I'm a fan of Seth, he says very vigorously in relation to dreams, look, recognize that in your dreams you're traveling in the realms you will inhabit after death. Actually, Dionne Fortune, the great priestess of the Western Mysteries, says the same thing. It's my impression, too. I mean, maybe I'm unusual, but I am often in scenes with people who have died, and I know they've died in the dream. It's not surprising to me that I'm with them, because I know we are in places that they have found or have created through their own imaginations. To come back to something you were talking about, because the imagination is the great architect and engineer of what we're going to encounter. I was just curious to know whether you had, not beliefs, but experiences that gave you a sort of a sort of itinerary or a map of the territory, it sounds as if you're open to letting that grow at the right time.
Yeah, I'll say yes to that. I have had experiences that have given me a profound sense of being alive while being in that bardo state, in that in-between state, and seeing different landscapes for different people. And those were all important and all truly cherished, and those people may go on and stay in states like that, but that's where I don't know, because I haven't followed them into that light. But I've certainly had dreams in which I was with people who were dying and kind of being with them through that transitional state. So that's why I keep coming back to that. It's just there's a place where I think we put into physical terms a non-physical connection that we have. So I had this experience when my mother died. My mother died in a car crash, and it was terrible, and I was feeling a lot of emotions and had a dream about her. It started out being a dream about these beings of light that were holding me through the funeral. So I was with a friend, and we were looking at pictures, and there were these beings of light. And then I got woken up suddenly by a loud noise, and so I got out of bed, and I checked around, made sure nobody was there. And as I came back to my bedroom, I saw my mother as a vision of light in a hallway, and she was ecstatic about being this being of light. And look at all this light I got. I'm an angel. I'm so happy. And there was something so clear about that, about her being there. And when I woke up the next morning, I knew that she was okay. I had had a visitation dream in which I knew she was okay. And looking at this, I have this sense, my own interpretation of this is that I felt a connection with my mother, and because I was kind of half awake, half asleep, I had a waking vision dream of what that would look like if she was in my house. But I think she was closer to me than in my house. I think she was in my heart and in my soul. And then I projected that out into something I could see and kind of wrap my arms around.
Yes, you combined your forces perhaps to create what used to be called a contact picture. You know, Jung had experiences like this when he's two wives, because he had two wives. One was Toni Wolff, one was Emma. They both died before him, which made him sad. But then when they appeared, they looked about 30 years old, very attractive, very beautiful, very well-dressed, and Jung began to speculate about why they took that form. And maybe you just explained some of it. I mean, partly projection on our side, partly what we remember, the best that we remember of someone, partly the way we wish them to be, and partly their readiness to slip into a form that is agreeable to both of us. I mean, after all, why have you just died? If you have some clarity on this, why go back as the old frail person that you were when you might be able to adjust your appearance and come back as a good-looking 30-year-old or whatever, or an angel in white, forgetting about age, and shifting it to a different level. It's so very, very interesting. Yeah. And, of course, our departed can come back later on as everyday angels. I mean, my father came back for years after his death with messages for the family that I was the one that could receive and pass on, and then he started showing me around the afterlife as he was experiencing it. This is very educational. This went on for some years. He made decisions about his next existence, he said, well, I'm going far away now, and you won't be able to talk the same way, which made me rather sad, except that he popped up years later to give me a warning that I needed to go and see a doctor. I had a spot of skin cancer on my upper lip. So he came back, or sent his semblance, or some spiritual agency sent a guide in his form with that message. So interesting. All right, we've been talking to Jean Van Bronckhorst, author of Dreams of the Threshold. We'll be back after the break. Basically, say thank you and dream on.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MossDreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Robert Moss, what a deep pleasure it has been to be with Jean Van Bronckhorst, author of Dreams at the Threshold, talking about her great care and concern and all the help she's given to people approaching death. Jean, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It was delightful. I'm very glad to have been here.
Well, so to everybody, as we go forward on the roads of soul and the roads of dreaming, may our doors and gates and paths be open, and may the doors and gates and paths of any who wish to do us or those we love any harm be closed. May it be so. Dream on.